Tonight, we are very pleased to welcome Jonathan Pershing, Deputy Special Envoy for Climate Change, the U.S. State Department, who will speak to us on climate change and international negotiations. Dr. Pershing holds a PhD in geology and geophysics from the University of Minnesota and a BA in geology from Queens College, City University of New York. He's been the State Department Deputy Special Envoy for Climate Change since March 2009. In this capacity, he serves as the department's senior climate negotiator and head of delegation at official level meetings of UN climate change conferences. From 2003 to 2009, Dr. Pershing served as director of the Climate, Energy, and Pollution Program at the World Resources Institute. Prior to that, he directed the Environment Program at the International Agency in Paris. And prior to that, he was science advisor and then deputy director of the Office of Global Change in the U.S. State Department's Ocean, Environment, and Science Bureau, where he was one of the principal negotiators for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol. Dr. Pershing is widely recognized for his work on international climate change architecture, including the design of a post-Kyoto Protocol climate change agreement. He has been a review editor and lead author of reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize awarded to the IPCC for its comprehensive assessment reports on global climate change. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Pershing as he speaks to us on climate change and the international negotiations.
Thanks very much. It's really great to be here. I was for a long time doing a fair amount of work in Illinois. A number of years ago, the state was doing a process in which they were developing a climate change plan. And Doug Scott, whom some of you may know, was involved in trying to set that up in terms of trying to develop a program for both Illinois and then subsequently to have it participate in part of a regional agreement of a Midwest initiative. And I was quite actively involved and got to come to Chicago quite a lot during that period. But it's been a number of years since I've been here, and it's a great pleasure to come back, and it's a great pleasure to be at the university where I actually have never had a chance to talk before. So thanks very much for the invitation, and I look forward to both this presentation, but a discussion afterwards and with any of you individually, but collectively on these particular issues. So I hope everyone can hear me, that the microphone is still not loud enough. Turn it off. So we'll use these ones, which might stand slightly closer to the podium mics. Is that good? Can you hear me now? Great. So let me walk through this presentation, starting off with some assessment of what the problem is. It's always kind of a useful context. Where are we? Why are we here? What matters? And I'll spend about half of my time trying to frame that, and then the second half of my talk trying to frame what we're doing about it, primarily on the international side. So you got some sense about the international dimensions of this. So this is a kind of a graphic, a cartoon, if you will, that frames the issue. And for those of you who have not really followed the climate change problem, the physics is relatively well understood, although the specifics are certainly you can argue about them. The broad outlines are contained here. What you've essentially got is that incoming solar radiation, comes in and it ends up being trapped and can't get back out again. And you trap it essentially by changing the composition of the atmosphere. And you're changing it through a variety of different gases. The name, the greenhouse effect, comes exactly from what you might think. If you've got and been to the library, it gets awfully warm if they didn't have the air conditioning in there. I just got to go see it now that it's been opened. If you sit in the middle of that library and have the sun coming in, the heat doesn't get out quite as easily as the light gets in. And that dynamic is a function of a number of different things, not least of which is the composition in the atmosphere. And so here's a graph that just shows you, in essence, that. A portion of the heat is transmitted and warms up the surface of the Earth. It warms up the oceans. It warms up the atmosphere. And as we change the composition of the atmosphere, we change the amount of heat that is essentially being trapped. So what are we doing? What are the concentrations? Which gases do we care about? There are a couple that are really quite significant. In this particular figure, what you see is something from a group called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was constituted now about 20 years ago to provide periodic assessments of our understanding of the science and the impacts and the responses to climate change. This is from their most recent report, which is now about 4 years old. They're in the midst of preparing the next report, which will be called the fifth assessment report. It'll be out in about 3 more years. This is the most recent kind of comprehensive database of peer-reviewed literature from around the world on the science. And what you can see from this graphic, and it's been replicated by any number of legitimate and real studies, what you see here are two different greenhouse gases. One is carbon dioxide, and the second is methane. And what you can see, these go back 10,000 years, you see a trend reasonably flat, and then in that last window since the Industrial Revolution, essentially a vertical change. Rapid increases in these gases. And the inset just shows that period essentially since the Industrial Revolution. So you can get some sense about the long-term trends as well as the fairly rapid, not fairly, but incredibly rapid numbers at the end. These two gases are the principal two human-induced gases for greenhouse that are changing the composition of the atmosphere and as a consequence leading to additional trapping of that heat. So what are the sources of these emissions? Here is the sources by gas. The red, that's that CO2 number that we saw rising so rapidly. The next one up is methane. That was the second one. There are a series of six gases that are actually often cited and certainly are covered under the international agreements. The rest are really quite small, and you can see the trend, the share of each in this pie. Nitrous oxide is about 7%, perfluorocarbons, hydrofluorocarbons, and sulfur hexafluoride remaining about 1% combined. So as you see, the bulk of these are in those first two, maybe the first three. Those are the ones we tend to focus on, but the ones at the end actually have fairly high consequences. So you may have very small volumes, but significant effect. They're very powerful in terms of the effect they have on the atmosphere, often much more powerful than carbon dioxide itself. So these represent quite small volumes, although with a significant impact. And where do they come from by sector? This particular one shows the pie chart by sector. And what's been broken out in the kind of reds and oranges and purples, those are all related to energy. So those are energy related. That's electricity and manufacturing on the energy side and transportation, the energy side. The greens and the blues, those are other kinds of gases, other sectors. They include industrial processes. That's where the perfluorocarbons come from, for example. Agriculture, very, very heavy on methane, but also from the fertilizer, nitrous oxides. You get land use change in forestry. Those are emissions from burning down your forests. Waste, methane emissions from the waste depositories. And what's called international bunkers, those are the pieces that refer to the fuel consumed by fleets of airplanes and by the maritime fleets running around the world distributing people and goods. Fairly small, but you see the wedges there. So as you take a look at that, what you've got is about 65% of the total in energy, about 35% in the other sectors. But we should be fairly clear. It is by no means an even distribution around the world. And what you see here are some of the regions and the distribution. The middle line represents the global average in 2008. And therefore, if you're below the line, and these are all done in percentages, Africa is give or take some about one quarter the global average. The United States, which is in the OECD total, it's not broken out separately, is about 5 times to 8 times the global average. So that's the range. You get the Africans at one extreme, the United States at the other. We are in good company. The Canadians are with us. The Australians are with us. All of our friends, many of whom are very high in the energy intensity of their economies. But you see quite a broad range in this discussion. And this particular slide comes from the International Energy Agency. It's a projection that was done by the World Energy Outlook, which is their economic projection of energy consumption. And they've got two pieces here. One is the yellow part. That's the 2008 number. The second is what they think will happen in more or less a business as usual case by the year 2035. And you can see quite a number of shifts. So you see Africa actually not doing very well. Doesn't actually get much bigger. But on the other hand, what you see is China with a substantial growth. And the reason it's relevant to think about this is coming at the end of the talk in the second part where I talk a bit about how you solve the problem. It's not a one-size-fits-all. you're going to have differentiation between countries, between regions, in terms of the kinds of solutions you have to imagine in order to make this work. Let's look just for a minute and kind of go from the global just to the United States. So here are the U.S. numbers. Remember that the total for CO2 in the world was about 65%. Here what you end up with is it's 85%. So much, much higher share. And in our case, it's very, very heavily on the energy side. So we are much higher in terms of where energy comes from. That's largely because for many of the developing countries, they are agricultural economies. And for them, it's much more methane, it's much more deforestation, it's other kinds of activities, not the energy-intensive ones that are at the heart of U.S. emissions. And here's our trend. This information comes from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This is a report that was actually in draft. The slide's about a month old. It actually came out last month. This, what you can see, is the trend from 2005 to 2009. And we've actually had a decline in U.S. emissions over that period. Now, in no small measure, that decline is a function of the declining economy. So as people consume less, as people produce less, as we use less oil, that shows up quite directly in these kinds of statistics. But we collect them, and we collect them in quite a lot of detail. This is the aggregate total of all of those six greenhouse gases combined in terms of their effect. And you see there's some stuff below the line that's in light blue instead of in the dark color. That's the amount that our forests are growing and absorbing additional CO2 out of the atmosphere. So there's actually some net balance that you have to do. How much is being emitted, how much is being subtracted, and the net comes out in this particular way. So where does that take us in 2010? So for those of you in the back of the room who can't quite read the bottom of these numbers, what you've got here is in purple, that's a decline in global average temperatures of about 3 degrees, and at the high end, an increase of about 5 degrees. This is degrees Celsius. And what you see here is the baseline. What are you measuring that change against? You're measuring against essentially a 30-year average, 1951 to 1980. And you've got all these cells and all these points, and you say, okay, how much has the temperature changed over that average of those 30 years at each point on the graph. And red, of course, is pretty warm, and purple is pretty cool. There's no purple on this diagram. There's a lot of red on this diagram. This is all historic. These are the three warmest years on record. 2010, since we've got the records, 130-odd years. 2005, which was tied for 2010, but in slightly different places. And you see, if you were to take any given point, try and find Chicago on that particular map, and you see that in one year it was slightly warmer, a little closer to the red, and the next year a little more in the orange. In both cases, it had gone up over the average, but no individual point's going to give you a good estimate. And I like to put this in very stark terms, because there are any number of people who say, well, in my particular town, it was cooler this year than last year, and therefore climate is not changing. So for those of you who are studying statistics, this gives you somewhat of a broader picture. The third warmest year on record, 1998. It's very interesting to look at the longer-term statistics. This past decade is warmer than the previous decade. The previous decade was warmer than the decade before that. It is a consistent trend. You can see those three, and you can see on the lower right-hand side, those are the 3 years, and you can see where it was in each month of the year. It's the collective average that we're looking at, and you see that at no individual point are they exactly the same. No individual month was hotter than all other months in the record. But this gives you some sense of some of the variability that's being collected. And this is done by by NASA, which is one of the places that collects that kind of information in the United States. And this is some temperature analysis that they have run to create these kinds of graphs. So this is all historic. Nothing about the future here. This is all history. Still on the history side, what kind of impacts have we already seen as a consequence of some of this warming? So here's two pieces on the ice, because ice is always interesting. People live in Chicago. You don't have the mountains, but you at least have the ice, right? So on the left side, you've got, these are some glaciers in fact, I think this particular slide comes from the Andes, not far out of Peru, out of Lima. And what you see at the top picture is about 80 years ago, and the bottom picture is about 2000. So you see just the sequence in terms of the rate of receding of that particular glacier. I lived for a long time in Alaska and worked up there. And for people who've been to Anchorage before, there's a glacier called the Portage Glacier, right outside of town. And if you travel to it, it usually that it came up to the road, and they put a visitor center in, and it was really cool, and this was in the 1980s. You could go walk right up to it, and you could kind of walk on it. It was very exciting. There is now a 5-mile lake between the visitor center and the front edge of the ice. So that's 25 years, not very long. I did some work in Lima. Lima's currently expecting the glaciers outside of town to be entirely melted by about 2025 or so. Lima's one of the driest deserts in the world. It gets a few millimeters of rain a year. It's substantially drier than the American Southwest. The entire plain, not just of Lima, but of the entire coastal plain of Peru, is watered by the ice melting out of the glaciers in the Andes. They've got two plans. One plan is to drill through the Andes and tap into the Amazon basin, because they think they can get the water out of the Amazon. But for people who think about climate, it turns out it's kind of connected, and the part of the Amazon they want to tap into is also drying. And of course, you think about the cost that it would be to drill through the Andes. We don't have any tunnels that even begin to think about that kind of scale. The second is they're proposing massive scale desalination, and that's something that's been tried in a lot of different places. And then you start thinking about the cost of that. Turns out that Peru has recently found a number of gas reserves, natural gas, and it's been exporting that, and has quite a lot of new income coming in as a consequence of the gas. The most recent studies that I've seen suggest that Peru would spend on the order of 90% of its reserves to pay for desalination just for the city of Lima. So you start thinking about these consequences. This is before I start projecting into the future. This is the current trends that we're seeing on these pieces. So let's now take the past, which doesn't look too promising, and try to project forward and think about what does the future hold? And how do you make that analysis? How do you examine where we are today and try to put some context around that of where we might be in 20 years or 50 years? How do we do that? The IPCC has followed a process which a number of different organizations have also run to think about doing projections into the future. And they've taken a series of different worlds. And all of these worlds are not about climate policy. They're worlds that happen in the absence of climate policy. And then you can superimpose whatever climate policy you want on top of them. What does that mean? It means you make assumptions about how the world's going to develop. How many people will there be? Do you use the high UN case of about 12 billion or the low UN case of about 9 billion? Do you use an aggressive economic growth rate of a global average to 2 to 3% per year globally, or a lower one of about 1% per year? What do you assume about technology? Do you assume that it'll grow incredibly quickly and you'll have a whole host of new technologies coming in the next 20 years? Or do you assume it'll be fairly slow? And why do you think that penetration rate might be different? Do you assume that the world is going to be a much more coherent place and things like the UN become organizations which can help countries move through with common objectives? Or do you assume that it will be much more fragmented and the system will be much more about individual countries doing individual things which may or may not link up particularly smoothly? Those are contained in the kind of projection analysis. And there are a series of scenarios, and you start putting them together. At the upper end of that, you've got that dotted line, that red dotted line. That's the fossil intensive scenario called A1FI. It was a scenario in which we said, we're going to be using a lot of fossil fuel. Coal is cheap. It's ubiquitous. We can get it. And by the way, those other alternatives, they'll come in, but because coal's cheap, because we're going to keep the prices down on oil, because we discover natural gas, we're not going to do it very quickly. At the bottom end, you've got some of those B scenarios. Those B scenarios are not about technology. They're about a different model. They're about a model which is really a sustainability model, much more frugal, much less consumptive of all global resources, very focused on a different kind of society, very integrated, quite efficient in terms of CO2. So here's some scenarios, and they are not projections of reality. They're scenarios of what you might see in these cases. If these kinds of circumstances were to prevail, you might imagine a world that could unfold with those consequences. Here's the U.S., just to give you some picture of one country into which you could plug that number. This is done, this was quite recent, just released by the Department of Energy about 2 months ago. This is the Energy Information Administration's projection through the year 2035. And you see that we're relatively flat, right? We grow a little bit, but not that much. So here's the U.S. This is the best projection of where we think we'll be, not with aggressive climate policies, but with the ones that are currently in place.
Let's take a look then at those scenarios we had before, recognizing the U.S. as a piece of the puzzle. And here's some of those same kinds of graphs that I was showing you historically. These come out of the models of those different scenarios. B1, that's that green one at the bottom. Look how much warming there is. Red, by the way, for those in the back who can't read it, red's still bad. The bottom one is the A2 scenario. This is not the upper bound. This is below the upper bound. That's the A2 scenario. It's a warming in the poles of about 7 degrees. Now, you start thinking about 7 degrees. This is Celsius, so it's about 14 or so degrees Fahrenheit. You just kind of double it more or less, get a round number. Is that really a problem? You know, you got up this morning and it was easily 14 degrees cooler than it is this afternoon. Do I really care if those kinds of changes occur? And the answer is, those glaciers that I was showing you, and now what I want to walk through, are some of the impacts with these kinds of shifts. Because you thought the glaciers were bad, you really haven't seen much in terms of what we think might happen. So here's one for Illinois, which I thought would be kind of interesting to show you. This is an analysis that was done by the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And they tried to do an assessment of what a series of places might look like and how you might think about the climate in the context of a changed world. And there's two different ones. Essentially, it's at the end of the 50-year horizon, 2040 to 2060, and the last 20 years of the century through 2100. And we've got two versions. The 2050 is the upper of the two, and the 2100 is the lower of the two, and two scenarios. One where emissions don't grow so quickly globally, and one where they grow quite quickly globally. And as you move south, it gets hotter, and as you move west, it gets slightly drier. So for those nice, cool winters that you've been experiencing, think more like Louisiana. This is the guess that the U.S. Global Change Research Program has to kind of put into context of where you are. I don't know how many of you are from Illinois or are from Louisiana or are from, in this particular case, East Texas, but kind of puts you in there by Galveston. So kind of contemplate the way it would feel to have the university in Galveston and you have some interesting changes in the dynamics and how you live. Let's look at it at a slight more global level. This is the map that was done by Coca-Cola. You think about places who do interesting research. So of all things that you might contemplate, Coke is unbelievably interested in water, unsurprisingly. It's a little sugar and a lot of water. And if you think about how much it takes, every bottle of Coke takes between 10 and 20 bottles of water equivalent to be manufactured. So it's quite water intensive. They've come down a long way. They used to be twice as much as that. So there's an enormous amount of work in terms of trying to think about the processing that they use to make that happen. So here's a map by Coke. They go back to 1975, and they take a look at water availability. And in this case, blue is good. And once again, red's not so good. Here's 2000. Take a look at the places, unsurprisingly about 2000, where it's happening. And here you see Africa. Unsurprisingly, it's the Saharan region of Africa drying out, a couple of places around South Africa that are really kind of moving down. India and China increasingly stressed. So here's a vision in there about stress. Red, by the way, is extreme scarcity. Yellow is stress. But one of the things that's interesting about this does averages. It takes an entire country and says, okay, the country's stressed. But what does that mean going forward? Well, further stress. This is 2025. But to me, this is the interesting piece. What does it mean when you start looking within a country? You no longer look at the average of the United States. You look at the Western United States. You look at the consequences in a particular part of the Andes. You look at the entirety of South Africa, not just by country, because the Southern Cape is doing okay, and the average, therefore, is not too bad. You look at the modifications in the Indian subcontinent. And at a more local level, they are extreme. Now you're looking at extreme scarcity in red, and it's no longer possible to say the country's doing well because you've got to have massive water transfer programs just to make this work. Here's the population at risk.
Is that 2003?
This is back 2003. This is already today. This is data that's today, and this is not projected forward. This one's projected forward because they haven't done it. This is 2025, their projection. But it's interesting. So here's the United States in that kind of light blue as a national total. Here's the United States if you subdivide it. And it's very clear. You start looking at water rationing discussions that are going on in the Colorado River Basin. It is happening now. So you no longer can start thinking about things in the aggregate. You have to start thinking about things that are more discreetly applied, and you have to pull them out, because the policies matter not only at the global level or at the national level. The policies matter at a local level. So here's the water stress numbers. This particular database analysis comes from the IPCC. This is the 2007 report that a lot of these figures are drawn from. And what you can see is what additional stress you might expect as the temperature goes up. And what you've got on the side is population with increasing stress, and those are measured in the millions of people. And what you've got on one side is northern Africa, on the other side, southern Africa. And this is the additional population under stress. And it climbs to between 100 and 130 million people in northern and another equivalent in southern Africa. So 200 to 250 million additional people under water stress. And you think about the current capacity and how they manage the existing stress today, and you add essentially this population to it and think about the implications. So you want to focus a bit closer to home. Here's the southwestern states. Here's some numbers that you can kind of see that the answer is partly what we're currently doing with climate as a bit of an extra consequence. What you've got in the blue is the renewable reserve. That's how much we can replenish. That's how much rainfall comes down. That's how much, you know, meltwater you've got coming in to replenish the reservoirs. In green, what you've got there is a bit of an overdraft. That's how much we're currently drawing down that is not being replenished. What you've got in yellow is how much we expect to grow as a function of population growth and industrial demand. And then added on to that, you've got the orange, which is the B1 climate, not too bad, and the red, the A2 climate, the upper end, but not the top end of that range. And so what you see in all these cases is we are already living beyond our means, and when you add climate, it just gets worse. So it's not a function that climate is the tipping point and everything's fine until climate comes along, and now with climate it's all horrendous. Climate makes it worse. These changes exacerbate an ongoing demand. You can fix it, it's just a little bit expensive. So on the right side, some pictures here, there's a paper that was written, pardon me, a couple of years ago, that suggests that the probability of Lake Mead being dry in about 10 more years is about 50%. If you think about Lake Mead, many of you have been out there, it's a pretty big place. The slide in the middle is the difference between 2000 and 2009 in terms of the level of the lake. It's gone down about 100 feet. And how long it took us to fill that 100 feet up with the Colorado River running through it? It's now going dry. Another 10 years at the rate we're going, it'll be dried out. The only reason it won't happen is we'll do a massive diversion of the Colorado River to try to replenish it, because Lake Mead is one of the primary water sources for Las Vegas and for Phoenix and for Los Angeles. So now you start thinking about a thing that comes home very, very quickly. You could do some work on this. The shortfall under current conditions, about $2+ trillion. But if you start adding it, the increased shortfall is $7 to $15 billion a year. That's just the increase in the costs of water to make up the shortfall, if you could purchase it, if you could find it. All right, not so worried about water. How about food? Maybe that kind of grabs you more immediately. Here's a food chart. This was done by the World Development Report. The World Development Report is a paper that's put out on an annual basis by the World Bank. And many of you have done some work with the World Bank. It's got a whole research arm, does quite a lot of analysis, focused on poverty, poverty alleviation, and managing those kinds of risks. This particular report, the person who was in charge of this report, a woman named Rosina Bierbaum, she was on loan to the World Bank. She's the dean of the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan. This particular study is drawn from a whole series of composite data on a whole variety of different sources. And what you've got here is the percentage yields, the decline of the percentage yields between today and 2050. And for those of you in the back of the room, red is bad. Doesn't look too bad if you're in Russia. Interestingly enough, Russia is actually not that worried about climate change. Russia's pretty interested in whether or not they may become a much more potent agricultural exporter in this new world. But then you start looking at other parts where people do live in enormous numbers and the risks that they are already faced with, and you see declining yields of as high as 50% in northern Africa, in the northern part of the Indian subcontinent, and on the range of 30 or so percent in much of the United States, and in most of Australia. So you start looking at these kinds of numbers, and they give you a very, I think, significant reason to worry. Here's one that narrowly focuses, again, on Africa. People who are kind of thinking about a population already really at risk. And this is a year before the World Bank report. This one's done by the United Nations Environmental Program. And this is the Environmental Food Crisis Study that they did in 2009. And what they've got here is 50% or more decline. And like that water graph, it begins to break it down often at the county level, at a much more discrete disaggregation of our information. You can start to see the dynamics of how this plays out over the course of the continent. Hurricanes. Actually, some dispute about this, and there are people in the audience who've done some thinking about this, and I think there's still open questions. This is a recent report that was produced and released a paper in Science in January of this year, and it was done by some folks at NOAA, and they were looking at hurricane tracks, the frequency of hurricanes that are more intense. The top is the present climate, and at the bottom is a warmed climate, more or less the equivalent of somewhere in the middle of the range that I was showing before in the course of the late 21st century. You see more or less a doubling of intense storms. Those are categories 4 and category 5. So a lot of people think that there may be some variability here. This may not be as accurate. There's some more recent stuff that there's a dispute about this still. But even if you have not quite this bad, a number that looks like that, and we think about the tornadoes as being exemplar, or we think about Katrina as being an exemplar, or we think about Rita as being an exemplar. This is just this basin. And you add this basin to the typhoons in the Asia Pacific, you add those to the hurricanes that come across in the Philippines and in India, and you've got really significant problems going forward. Or you're more worried about disease. Here's an interesting statistic. So it turns out that the malaria-bearing mosquito breeds more quickly when it's warm. Pretty much more quickly. The graph on the top tells you the rate of breeding, the number of days between the cycles, the generations, and the temperature. So the temperature, as you get a temperature that goes from about 20 degrees up to about 30 degrees, you go from 30 days to 10 days, three times as often. One of the problems is that also means genetic mutations are faster. That means drug resistance is faster. In this particular instance, on the left side, you've got the malarial infestations and infections in 2000. And this is all Zimbabwe. And on the right side, in 2050. And I keep harping on this, but for those in the back of the room, red is bad. So all of this has its own intrinsic problems. You've got a water problem, you've got a food problem, you've got a disease problem, and they add up to a kind of instability. This particular graph was developed by the United Kingdom's Department of Defense, because what they were worried about was stability. They were about security in a pretty basic way. So the first thing they did was they mapped water scarcity, and these are just blobs to reflect more or less the graphs that I was showing you before. These are areas with significant scarcity today. And then they put on top of that demography. These are areas with significant population growth, with population pressures, with existing difficulties in that domain. And they put on top of that crop decline. And you start seeing where all these things are happening. This is a function of change in demand, change in arable land, the fertility of the arable land. And they put on top of that hunger, which of course is not unsurprisingly very closely linked. And they put on top of that the areas where sea level might rise and expose populations because of climate change to a risk. And then they put on top of that areas of recent conflict. You get this very interesting vision. It's not about climate change itself being the whole issue. If we had a robust and resilient system with a big buffer, we'd be okay. But we don't. We have a system that's living on the edge in many, many circumstances. And what we're doing with climate change is exacerbating those. So here's a summary slide that kind of puts together the impacts. This is done by a guy named Nicholas Stern, former chief economist at the World Bank, now at the London School of Economics. Very interesting guy. I did a report called the Stern Review. A little bit of an ego, I assume, there in that name. But having said that, he's a great guy in spite of that. Having said that, he did this interesting report, tried to collate these. This is called the Burning Embers chart. There was a variant of this particular chart that was done in the third IPCC assessment, and he updated it. So it's a very nice kind of summary slide, and you start seeing, for those in the back of the room, that red, which is bad, really starts happening pretty significantly between 1 and 2 degrees. And when you're much above 2 degrees, you're pretty much in the red zone on many, many issues. On food, possible rise in yields in some high-latitude countries like Russia, but overall, falling yields. Water, ecosystems, we're already seeing massive dieback in the coral reefs around the world. For anybody who dives, I'd strongly urge you go sooner rather than later. And it's pretty quick. These things happen at an unbelievable rate. For any of you who've actually been to some of these places and have been diving in them, if you've been, for example, diving in the Caribbean, the level of decline in the Caribbean reef is startling. And it's a function of two things. It's a function primarily of too many people picking at the coral, and a function of the land use that's right nearby with effluents coming off and destroying it. But it's also a function of periodic warm trends that have changed the surface temperature and the shallow temperatures in those areas, and they lead to the death of almost all the coral polyps. And so you see, instead of that phenomenal color, you now see a dead coral reef, which is stunning architecturally of all this really amazing stuff, but there's no color anymore. And there's very little life. And you see that in much of the Central Caribbean. And you are seeing it increasingly around a great deal of the barrier reef in Australia. And you're seeing it in the coral off of Saudi Arabia. Unbelievable shifts, and they're quick. They occur in the span of, in some cases, weeks to months. So, that's the first part. Let's take a look at what you can do, because I don't want to leave you entirely depressed, just mostly depressed. And I'm going to focus now more on the international dimension of some of the solutions in terms of where we might go. So you got really three choices. You can reduce emissions, you can adapt to climate change, and this last point is something that John Holdren, who's the president's science advisor, likes to stress, you can suffer. And unfortunately, I think we're going to have a fair amount of the third, because I don't know that we're going to do enough of the first two. So be prepared as you guys think about where you're going in the next 20 years of your lives to deal with that last bullet. Here's the timeline of the international negotiations. So we began thinking about this problem a long time ago. This is not a new issue, but it's an issue which really has only absorbed the international community for about 20, 25 years. We began in 1990 with a decision that was taken at the UN. And the UN General Assembly decided it had to work on climate change. It had to begin addressing this issue. And so it came through and said, okay, how are we going to manage this? We should go back and really think about putting together a treaty. Turned out that IPCC thing that I was talking about had a fourth committee back in the late 1980s. And the fourth committee was a policy committee that was supposed to think about institutional arrangements. And it made some recommendations that we should try to do a treaty, and that got picked up by the UN. And the UN said, okay, let's do a treaty. The first George Bush, who was at that point president of the United States, said, good idea, we'll host. And the United States hosted the first agreement. One of the first things that I did when I came to the State Department was to help organize that first meeting. And it's a great story. We didn't have a room because the president had promised this in late December at the UN General Assembly meeting. And we're going to do the meeting in February. And 190 countries were going to show up. And we promised them a space in Washington. And of course, a month out, every space was reserved. And you don't have all that many spaces that are available. So we look around. It turns out that not far from Dulles Airport, which is the international airport in Washington, there was a new hotel going up. And it was not going to be open by the time we wanted to use it. It was going to open about 3 weeks later. And we were able to get them to kind of advance their schedule and make the space available to us. So here we are negotiating an agreement on climate change, which is in some sense about overconsumption. This is a 5-star hotel. This is a hotel in which every morning they came out with a coffee spread, and it was a table about as big as the front of this entire room. And it was piled high at about 3 to 4 feet with exotic fruits that had been flown in from South America. And it had ice sculptures in the middle of it that were melting away as we were speaking. This was like the epitome of overconsumption. And we spent the first 2 weeks figuring out what we're going to do, and we had this meeting, and it kicked off a process that was remarkably quick. And by 1992, we had actually finished the Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it was adopted at a meeting called the Earth Summit, the Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992. Quite an interesting meeting. Its focus was primarily not climate. It was on a variety of different things that had to do with the environment and development. It was trying to link those issues together. Two major treaties were signed then. One was the Climate Change Convention. The second was the Convention on Biological Diversity. We also had a statement on forestry. We had a statement on sustainability, something called Agenda 21, which had 40 different chapters dealing with everything you could possibly imagine. Women, education, health, environment, jobs. Huge diversity of issues in thinking about our development agenda and sustainability in that particular context. What did the convention do? The convention essentially set us up as a framework to think about what might come next. We were unable to agree on specific targets, but we were able to agree that we would need to think about a broad vision. And that vision was essentially to try to avoid dangerous human interference to the point where it would damage the development of societies, to the point where it would be negative in terms of economic growth, negative in terms of people's welfare. That was the vision. We didn't have a number. This was right about the time that the first assessment report came out, so we were way back in the early stages of doing these large-scale global assessments. And we didn't have political agreement to do much more than that. But it set up a framework. The United States is party to that agreement. We ended up passing it forward. It went to Congress, was deliberated for not quite one day, and passed through. The person who was at that point, the Environmental the Protection Agency Administrator, was Bill Riley. Under the Bush administration, he went up and testified on behalf of the negotiations, and Congress, with virtually no objection, passed this agreement. For those of you who don't really follow international law, the U.S. requirement is that you have to have a two-thirds majority to pass a treaty. This is a treaty. Two-thirds is a pretty tall order, pretty significant hurdle, and we'll come back to that as we talk more about what we're doing next. But that dynamic was manageable and managed in 92. But it didn't have a lot of specifics in it. Fast forward a few years, people are clearly aware of the gaps in the agreement and want to do something more. They want to have a next step in the process. And then negotiate a protocol to the agreement, which is essentially an addendum, a framing of what you might do underneath the agreement to add specificity. That protocol was negotiated also in pretty short order. It took a little less than 2 years. It was adopted in Kyoto, and hence its name, the Kyoto Protocol. Very, very interesting negotiation. Completed in 1997. Has a number of key pieces, partly coming out of the convention and partly new developments on its own. First, it basically said that the world should be divided up into two parts. The one part are those members of the developed countries, groups of what are called membership in the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. That's a body that today has about 35 members, back then had about 30 members. The Russians, at that point, were still the former Soviet Union, or the Soviet Union was in, but others were not in. Mexico was not in. Korea was not in. China was certainly not in. We did that negotiation. That was the first piece. We separated those two. Those who were in the developed country camp were to take on commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Those who were not were supposed to take actions, but the commitments were not specific. So work versus specifically reduce by X amount. The United States was on the hook to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions 7% below 1990 levels. And there was a period of 2010 to 2012, and over that period, averaged over that period, you had to have your emissions reduced by 7% below the base year of 1990. The European Union's countries individually, an 8% reduction. The Canadians, for example, a 6% reduction. So not much differentiation between the countries. That was the first piece. The second piece about the Kyoto Protocol was that it set up the idea of doing international markets on climate change. The vision was that the best way to really make a difference is to put a price on the good, a price on the commodity. So if I'm going to have to pay something for my carbon, I'm going to be a little bit more frugal about how I emit it, how I waste it. And that model has been tried in a number of other cases to some substantial success, most significantly in the United States, where we had at that point tried emissions trading for sulfur as part of the Clean Air Act. And we'd had enormous success with it. Proposals that people thought would cost literally thousands of dollars a ton were in the $100 range. Very, very significant reductions in terms of the price. And a lot of it had been done by experimentation, by companies going out, now that there was a price on this commodity, looking to see how they could find alternative scenarios and alternative solutions. The idea here, Give countries their allocations, let them trade, let them find other ways to reduce at least cost, because you don't really care where it comes from. The atmosphere mixes up these gases pretty quickly anyway. The big thing is to do as much as you can, and keeping the price down will help you do more. Those are the two big things that came out of Kyoto. The United States did not ratify this agreement. For those of you who were around then, it was an interesting series of ads. For those of you who weren't, I'll just describe one of them. We had a commercial run by an alliance that was strongly opposed to this action. It felt it was too costly. The United States should not do this. And there was a great advertisement that was up there, and it was a map of the world. And there's this very deep-voiced announcement. It comes over the background, and all you see is the map and a hand with a scissors. And he cuts out China, and China flutters to the ground. And he cuts out India, and India kind of comes down. And he cuts out Mexico, and Mexico comes down. And he cuts out Korea. And all these countries are U.S. competitors. And the answer was that what was left were countries with whom we were really not competing. And they had obligations. And we had obligations. But countries with whom we were competing, the Chinese, the Koreans, didn't have any obligations at all. And it was quite resoundingly clear that Congress was not going to pass this agreement. But we should also know something about this agreement. We are the only country in the world which didn't pass it. The only one. Everybody else did. The little guys passed it. Liechtenstein is in. You guys all know where Vanuatu is, I'm sure. Tuvalu is probably right next door to most of your backyards. They passed it. The big guys passed it. All of Europe passed it. Japan passed it. Canada passed it. Russia passed it. The United States did not. We are the only country in the world that's outside of this agreement. So the fact that we have a different view does not mean it's a widely shared view. And that dynamic plays out very strongly in what comes next. Because by strongly rejecting it, we've made it very hard for the world to move forward. Until about 2 years ago, the United States was the world's largest emitter, and we were out. Fast forward a bit further. Entry into force took a long time because the United States was out. That's what that EIF stands for. It took 7 years for the agreement to enter into force. The convention entered into force about a year after the signature. Much, much faster. But we still haven't done enough. So we come then to the most recent round of discussions. We get to Bali, which is one of these annual meetings. Every year we have a meeting of all the parties to the convention, and everyone comes together and tries to figure out what we're going to do next and where things are. Bali launches a new process. They're all expecting a new election. George Bush has had his second term. He's going to be out. This is the last meeting he's attending. Everyone wants to set a process in motion that will be for whoever the new guy is, because it couldn't possibly be a guy who's as negative. Because remember, at that point, it was Obama running against McCain. And McCain had announced a whole series of policies which he had sponsored in the U.S. Congress. So it was quite clear that whoever was going to be president was going to have a more robust and aggressive climate policy. So we get to this big negotiation, and they set up a process. And we're supposed to conclude a new agreement in 2 years. And the 2 years are supposed to be concluded in Copenhagen in 2009. So here's Copenhagen. A little hard to see it. At the top, the president came. On the right side, the president did this deal. For those of you who are history students, it's kind of a fascinating exercise to think about a negotiation of this sort. There are very, very few times in the history of the world where heads of state negotiate anything. That's any people like me, right? You go off and go to the negotiation, do your thing, come back, I'll let you know if you did a good job or not. We've got almost no cases. You go to Versailles, where you ended up at the end of World War I with a significant investment by Wilson. He goes and spends months doing this deal. It's a handful of countries, half a dozen countries at the table. That's it. It was a shorter meeting. It only took about, the time the president was there, only a few days. But at the end of the day, he had 40 heads of state around a table, and they did a negotiation on this deal. There are no other cases that I'm aware of in any area of international discourse in which that kind of negotiation has taken place. It's startling. So a few stories to kind of explain it. That was not the intent. We did not plan to do it this way. The president does not go places without a pretty clear agenda, because the political risk is high. And you don't stick your principle out there and say, good luck, I hope you can make it happen. You back away a little bit and say, I'm not sure this is going to work, maybe you shouldn't go. And up to the last minute, it was pretty clear that that was going to be the recommendation, because nothing was working. So we have a process. I do my thing. I'm in these negotiations. I'm unsuccessful. I get my boss to come. He's doing his thing. He's unsuccessful. Secretary Clinton shows up. She's our foreign minister, our Secretary of State. She comes, she brings with her a commitment the United States is prepared to think about a long-term financial share of raising $100 billion per year for climate change. Still can't get a deal. The president comes with this. Nothing has worked. They do not have an agreement. They can't make the arrangements between them work out. So here's where the advantage of being a community organizer, I think, really stands in his stead. He comes to this meeting, and there is a room in which the countries that we really care about are having a chat. Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. It turns out that the Prime Minister of China was supposed to be meeting with the President, and it didn't happen. They'd gotten, the times hadn't worked, and they hadn't yet had a chance to have a meeting. And it turns out the President's guy finds this group of people as he's walking down the hall, that these guys are all sitting there. And the President says, hey, I'm going to go in. I'll just talk to them. And he goes in, and he talks to them. And they work out a deal. So they then come back to the large room with about 40 countries. And that's on the right. You can kind of see it. They're all kind of, we're all hovering over everybody. It's this room that's about a third the size of this space. We're at a table. All the advisors are kind of gathered around the back. It's really hot. We're all exhausted. We've been up for 50 hours trying to make this thing work. And we actually cut this agreement. And you see at the end where things have gone forward. But it turns out it was blocked. Because what ended up happening is that there were 40 countries in the room, but there were 130 countries not in the room. And the 130 countries said, oh, glad you worked out a deal, but it doesn't apply to me. I wasn't in that deal. I might like it, but I wasn't in it. I wasn't part of the deal making, and I will not have an agreement go forward if I'm not part of it. Now, to a certain extent, that was a degree of an effort mounted by a couple of countries who take great pride in pushing back on the process. So you had the ALBA countries, the Bolivarian states, includes Bolivia and Ecuador and Nicaragua. They don't like the United States. Anything smacking of capitalism is a bad idea. You had the OPEC countries, whose view was that almost anything being done to reduce the consumption of fossil fuel was a bad idea. And then you had some of the outlying states. It turned out that there's a grouping of countries called the developing countries. They're called the Group of 77, because when they first were formed, there were 77 countries part of it, but not about 140 countries part of it. They're being led by, of all stalwart players, Sudan. For those of you who follow Sudanese politics and policy, you don't think of them as kind of the epitome of social justice and equity. Sudan was leading the developing countries and was delighted to stand up and say, they were actually in the room. But he said, our coalition was not adequately represented. We can't let this go. So here's this remarkable deal which doesn't get concluded. We go forward and we get to Cancun, which is just this past December. So here's Cancun. Here's some of the key players in Cancun. We got some interesting folks there. Cristiana Figueres is the new executive secretary. The ALBA is the ambassador trying to make this all work because the host country is also the president of the meeting and chairs the meeting. Felipe Calderon, who's the president of Mexico, very, very engaged, intimately involved in this process. Patricia Espinosa, their foreign minister. She's an amazing woman, very articulate, very focused. Calderon basically says, I want this meeting to happen, and I want a success. And I do not want to replicate what happened in Denmark and Copenhagen, make it work. And Patricia is the person who had to make it happen, and her key ambassador was Luis Alfonso. So in the middle, you see the kind of podium that's set up for these meetings, and across the bottom, some of the key players in the process. Todd Stern, who's the envoy and for whom I work in the process. He's the United States representative. Tim Grosser. You wouldn't think that New Zealand would have a big play here, but Tim's been very, very active. He's also the trade minister. Next to that, you've got two other players, Luis Machado. He's the Brazilian negotiator. Major, major player. All the forestry stuff, a function of his acquiescence. And he's negotiating with a guy named Leon Charles. Leon Charles is one of the key players from Grenada. There's a whole coalition, 50 states that are small islands and who are threatened with inundation by a rising sea. They form a powerful block of countries very, very aggressively supporting rigorous action. Key player. Jairam Ramesh, he's the environment minister from India. And at the far end, Xie Zhenhua, he's the Chinese negotiator, the vice minister of the central planning committee with this responsibility. Ministerial level people, actively involved, not head of state, but ministerial. And the key thing that was done in Cancun was to take the political agreement reached in Copenhagen and turn it into an agreed text. And there was a lot of stuff on the side. You start looking at some of the color. Pablo Solon, he's one of the leaders of the Bolivarian states. the only country to try to block something in Cancun. We had 5 standing ovations when we tried to adopt this deal, and after every one, he would stand up and say, "I object." Kind of think about what it's like to do that. Here's a room of ministers from around the world, and you've got an ambassador from a country standing up saying, "I object," all by himself. There were no other voices. And he did it 5 times. It's unbelievable. You also had all kinds of people in the outside world who were paying a lot of attention. Here's some of the kind of NGO presence that you see across the side. You see lots of activity. It was a lovely place to have a meeting. I recommend meeting in Cancun when you can. So we kind of beat the spring break by a couple of months. You kind of see some of the things that they put up, a lot of publicity generated around some of those agreements, really quite an activist community as part of the process. What did Cancun deliver? The first one was we tried to update the shared vision. We dealt with adaptation as a first matter. We dealt with additional action on mitigation. We tried to look at transparency. How do you know what countries are doing? We dealt with finance, we dealt with deforestation, and we dealt with technology. So what's the shared vision? We've now moved away from this fairly ambiguous framing of trying to avoid dangerous human activities to a much more specific thing where we first acknowledge that it's unequivocal. So we're no longer saying as a global community, well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. We're saying it is. And we're saying you have to make deep cuts. And we're choosing a number at which those cuts should be made of 2 degrees. If you recall from that first part of the talk, somewhere around 2 degrees, you got into the red and out of the yellow. We've agreed to try to work toward a goal in 2050. And we've agreed that you have to have stakeholders, not just governments, but civil society, academics, business in the mix. Because you're not going to solve it just with a governmental approach. That's the new framing vision for the agreement. For the first time in any of the agreements that we've done, adaptation has pride of place. We've resolved that we will no longer solve the problem and avoid damages. We used to, in some hubris, think we would. We've now acknowledged we will not. And there will be consequences, and adapting to those consequences has got to become a higher priority. And we've agreed to do that. The first stage really is to do some planning. Where will it hit? What kind of consequences are there? What can you do to militate against and vitiate some of those consequences? How do you manage that? And the way bodies like this work is they'll set up some committees to make that process go forward and examine some of these next steps. And then we come to mitigation. What are you going to do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and how will that play out? We ended up deciding that we'd have this no longer just developed and developing. We agreed that we'd end up with the developed and the developing acting. So it's not just the United States, it's also China. It's not just Mexico, which was not in before, but it's some of the other places like India and Indonesia that will also act. It's a big departure from where it'd been before. If we take a look at the current emissions in the Kyoto Protocol, they represent about 25% of world emissions. Take a look at the emissions represented in Cancun, they're between 80 and 90% of world emissions. So a huge step forward in trying to work on the problem. And here they are. This is what countries have committed themselves to try to do. Brazil, 36 to 39% reduction below business as usual. China, 40 to 45% reduction. Indonesia, Mexico, the US, a 17% reduction, which is not so high, but let's take a look at some of those things that we are doing in that context. These are some things that were announced in this administration. These are things that are all new under the Obama administration that we've been done to do. We had a significant part of the stimulus package devoted to clean energy and to looking at greenhouse gas emissions. Energy efficiency, renewable energy, smart grids, carbon capture and storage, that's CCS, clean energy manufacturing, substantial new investments on the energy side, and a whole host of policies that go with those energy programs and that financing. New standards for vehicle efficiency, both for trucks and for cars. Proposals for electric vehicles, which many of you may have seen. New standards for large stationary sources. Those include power plants, but also large manufacturing facilities. An 80% effort to get electricity from clean sources, which is double the current total. And a whole series of programs in the land sector to do a better job at managing our croplands and our forests to reduce emissions. How do they compare, United States, to others? So here's a number of different comparisons. Remember, the Kyoto Protocol was set up against 1990. You had to do something between 2008 to 2012 versus 1990. So the upper left hand shows what we would be doing going forward against 1990. Not so good, about 3%. That's because we've done nothing really between 1990 and about 2010. So we didn't have a whole lot of a basis on which to draw. But if you use 2005 as a basis and think about where we all are in that context, that's where our 17% number is drawn from. The EU is somewhere in the middle, and they've got a number of either 20% reduction or 30%, and they haven't told us yet which one it'll be. Our 17 is right in the middle against that number. Or if you look at a per capita reduction, ours is near the upper end of their range, because we've got a significant population growth. A lot of it's immigration, but the EU is essentially flat. Or you look at it in terms of energy intensity, and ours, again, is right in the middle. So a lot of this comparison of where you are as a country depends on what metric you choose. We have to be more or less comparable with the other developed nations in our agreement, and this suggests that we really are. The agreement also called for some transparency. One of the visions here is that if you report on what you're doing, you are more likely to generate interest in and understanding of what you've got, and countries can move forward to take the next step. And it's transparency for developed and developing countries. We now have a work program to further elaborate what those provisions might be. And we have some significant new agreements on finance. Because we should be very clear, you are not going to solve this problem for free. But you have to think a little bit about what the costs of the alternative would be. Just look at those water figures that I put up there earlier. Those were measured in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars just for the American West. Now make that a global number. So what we're proposing here are two pieces. One is something that moves forward right away. Start it right now. An effort to put up $30 billion over 3 years. It's a lot of money until you start considering what else we spend money on, and that's a pretty small number. But at the same time, it's a lot of money. But the idea is ultimately to get, by the year 2020, to $100 billion a year. This was the piece that Secretary Clinton brought with her when she came to the negotiations to try to move things forward, and we did ultimately agree it as part of the process. It will not be foreign assistance. It'll be a combination of foreign assistance and investment money and private sector flows, and it will come from all countries, not from the US. So it's a complete effort to move forward on financing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and to improve adaptive capacity and resilience. And we'll set up a new fund through which part of this will flow and a committee to oversee the financing and the process. We'll deal with deforestation. Some 15-odd percent of global emissions come from deforestation. And managing that as a separate problem was agreed to be a key focus of our collective effort. Known as REDD+, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, the plus includes things like agriculture. So some of the agricultural drivers for deforestation will be considered. And we agreed to do some work on technology. A new mechanism to try to think explicitly about how we move technologies we already have and how we develop the next generation of technologies that we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There's a bunch of work to be done on all of these pieces, but this was all adopted in Cancun. We came out of Copenhagen with two pages, quite short. That's what heads of state do. They synthesize the pithy requirements and really distill them into a key political document. That was elaborated in Cancun, and we have about a 40-page text out of Cancun with all of these details now agreed. So what's next? Well, this year, we go to Durban. The meeting in Durban, in our view, should be a meeting at which we begin to implement and move forward the implementation of the agreements in Cancun. But others disagree. Others say, that's great, glad you did that, but where is the legally binding treaty? Because this wasn't legally binding. Where is the obligation to move forward to assure us that we get not to 2 degrees, but 1.5 degrees? Which might be a good number, but we didn't agree that. And nobody thinks that we can. The politics are not there to probably do those things. There's a very plausible scenario in which Durban is a very bad meeting, in which Durban is a meeting in which the rhetoric vastly outweighs the action, and instead of having agreement on the things that you might move forward and some pragmatic approach, you have very high rhetoric and very little action and a lot of blame. And I can easily see that happening. Our hope from the US side is that this next deal will be about implementation. We'll begin to move forward on some of these provisions that we've adopted, set up these structures, move on the technology, examine the provisions for being transparent, and make those happen and make them real, and then take a global step forward, which would allow us to take a next step into the future. And those are pretty straightforward. Need some domestic action, and the U.S., notwithstanding the list that I put up, still doesn't have congressional policy. And it's very hard to imagine in this Congress that we will get it. This Congress is averse to most greenhouse gas policy. And it's remarkably, to me, become a partisan issue. And as someone who is trained in the sciences, it's disappointing, it's disheartening, it's dismaying to see that kind of partisan divide over what I think of as a fairly clear-cut question. I think there's legitimate room for disagreeing about the how you act. I am very concerned that the thing has become whether it's a problem or not. There's a National Academy of Sciences report, which is the preeminent body that thinks about the science and the science across multiple sectors, multiple issues. Released a report called America's Choices, America's Climate Choices. The last volume came out a couple of weeks ago. And it made explicit that the academies think we are still faced with this really, really severe, increasingly urgent problem. The day after the report came out, Mr. Rohrabacher, who's the head of the science committee, said it was probably a fraud. That's a pretty remarkable statement for the head of the Congressional House Science Committee to make about a report. It staggers me. But we therefore don't have policy, and the absence of that kind of congressional policy makes moving some of these things forward much, much more difficult. We're going to have to work on technology, and there is some move on the technology side, and we can come back to some of those pieces, but there's some movement on that front, and we'll, I hope, see a bit more progress on the technology side. We've got to share information. People are doing things around the world, at local levels, at national levels. It's an interesting merger that just happened between the Bloomberg program on C40, which is big cities around the world, and the Clinton Global Initiative on cities, which is big cities around the world, try to combine forces with some money and some capacity. Bloomberg is currently the mayor of New York. Rahm Emanuel has indicated that he will continue to play as the mayor of Chicago. We've got a lot of people playing at that level. The states are still moving. Countries around the world are moving at localities and at individual levels. And that information is valuable. We have to capture it. And we need to know about it. We need to be transparent about it. Because I think that one of the things that will make us more comfortable acting as a nation and as individuals is to have some confidence that the rest of the world is doing the same thing, and that we've not gone off by ourselves to act, but are part of a global effort to solve a really difficult problem. And if we get that, we can then have another round of international negotiations. And those can generate agreements, maybe bilateral, US and China, India and Brazil. We can have plurilateral ones, ones that bring a group of countries together. And we can perhaps have new multilateral ones that set more specificity into the global arrangement. Let me stop with that, and thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
One of the more hopeful ways of dealing with this problem until the last few months has been the possibility of using nuclear energy, which with all of its negative sides had a very positive side. It's something we know how to do, how to use to make a lot of energy very quickly. Now that just seems to be completely off the table. And what kind of an effect will that have on dealing with this problem? It's completely off the table as far as I can see now.
So, 2 points. The first, I don't really think it's off the table in the long term. People may have different views whether it should or shouldn't be. I think it's off the table in the immediate term. Japan had planned to build 25 new nuclear reactors as part of its climate change initiative to reach its emissions reductions goals. It now will have them, they're all on hold. But all the information that I've got from the Japanese suggests that they're probably going to come back at it because the alternative is coal. And the question really is, how do you think about weighing the damages and the consequences? And would there have been scenarios in which they could have built or designed their plant differently to have fewer damages? Many of you probably have seen some of the data around the design flaws. There are a number of reports that are now coming out that suggest that they knew about those years in advance and had thought the plant was going to be shut down before it had any problems, and it obviously was not. Other countries moving more aggressively to stop things. Germany, for example, at one point had talked about literally shortly before Daiichi, had talked about extending the life of its nuclear power plant fleet. Angela Merkel, who's the prime minister, had decided that was going to be probably a useful thing to do, in no small measure to help her meet her climate change objectives. But the hue and cry in Germany, which has got a very strong history on the nuclear issue, has led her to then look at more early retirements and no new builds. And it states probably pursuing a much more cautious course, neither the Japanese model nor the German model, still exploring what we might do, looking at different design features that might manage this. But I think you're quite right, it's not going to be immediate in any event. It's a problem. Give or take, some about 20% of the world's electricity comes from nuclear power. Not quite. And if you start looking at removing that, what do you replace it with? Almost all of it will be fossil fuel, given the price point at which fossil fuel plays in the renewable nuclear fossil fuel market. It's a huge issue. I think when I come back at it, I think there's going to be a big effort to think about bringing the price of alternatives down. But I look to see now some of the other countries that are moving forward. China's got about 50 nuclear plants on order. They have not stopped those constructions. There's a microphone coming.
Yeah, as you were speaking to some people at the beginning, before your presentation, I started to wonder why you were here and trying to figure out how you connect to Rahm's administration. Is that why you're here, and will you talk a little bit about that?
No. I'm actually here because my daughter's a student here. But I'm here because I actually like to come and do talks like this. I try to get around and do them. I probably do about 5 or 6 schools every year, and I try to do them around the country. And I have not had a chance to come to Chicago before. Rahm's interesting on this issue. I have had a little bit of a chance to work with him. I don't know him particularly well at all. As chief of staff, this was one of the issues that he worried about. We, I think, had a fair amount of momentum early on in trying to move this. Other political things intervene. And one of the problems that I think you'll all see as a consequence of politics of the moment is that you're moving down a course and something else happens. And it throws a wrench in those well-laid plans that you've got of what you intend to do. And so even in the last, 6 months, so Rahm left to run for mayor, and we've got a new chief of staff, very interested in climate. And what happens? Libya happens. And it gets in the way. Gets in the way. How do you argue that the Arab Spring is getting in the way of anything? It's an extraordinary series of events. But it takes the attention away and the political ability to focus on this issue away. Interesting polling numbers, though, are out there as well. A year ago, the polls that were done by a number of different organizations suggest that 65% of Americans, 66 actually, percent of Americans thought that climate change was a serious or significant problem. The most recent poll was done about a month and a half ago. It was 51%. Now, is that because it's gone down and people think it's a less serious problem? Well, interestingly enough, almost all the science went the other way. A couple of years ago, you had the science saying there are some issues, there are some questions. Now the science is much more unequivocal. Not that it really is very different, but people are more willing to announce or to pronounce on it. But other things have intervened. We had a bad economy. And a bad economy certainly takes precedence over what might happen in Central Africa in 2030. And those dynamics play out in a very, very significant way. And they also play in terms of the public politics. And you have a shift in what Congress is interested in doing and its priorities. And you get people responding to those new priorities. And that's what's in the news. And so you're seeing, I think, a bit of a shift in that regard as well. It is interesting what Rahm's trying to do in Chicago. There's this significant initiative that's been mounted here in the city looking at the adaptation requirements for the city itself. Part of the Green Roofs program is going to continue. The work that's looking at air conditioning and the requirements in a new environment is going to continue. So a lot of work on greening the city that hopefully will ameliorate some of the impacts. Some of the revetments and construction along the lake will continue. Things that people are really worrying about as a consequence of climate change are ones that he has indicated he will continue in his administration. So in that sense, I think he's absolutely engaged. Yeah, please. So the recent information that I've seen suggests that you cannot make any assertion about this set of tornadoes. There are people like Mike Schlesinger, who's here, who's in the front, who's done some analysis on things like this. I'd probably get a much better answer, a more sophisticated answer from him. My own sense about the process, it'll be a very long time before any individual event is mappable or predictable. much less the trajectory of that particular event. That slide that I put up that had a projection of the intensity of hurricanes with tracks was in some sense a randomization exercise around an expected intensity increase. It's by no means a projection of in 2035 expect those 17 storms to occur in those ways. I do not believe we will ever be in a position to make that statement. In the near term, there is some information that suggests that we are improving slightly in our ability to project weather and particularly extreme events. I had a briefing not very long ago, actually last week, from somebody who's doing some private sector development of weather stations. And they're looking at mapping things like storm cells and storm tracks. NOAA does a lot of this. The FAA is involved in some of this because of the aviation issues. But there's been some quite interesting things about projecting fairly near-term storm tracks. They can get things that are as much as an hour in advance, probably not much more than that. But that's a significant number when you start looking at some of these events, which if you had an hour's warning might make a huge difference. So we seem to be moving down that road. I'd be very surprised if we're going to have specificity on any individual storm anytime soon.
I've been arguing with a friend of mine for a couple of years about climate change. He's a, or has been a commodities trader for the Board of Trade. And he said that the United States was never going to take the issue seriously until the market took it up as an issue and started acting on it. And I hadn't had much success with him in arguing these points until yesterday at the pool hall when I mentioned an article I read in the New York Times about Swiss Re. You probably know about this. The reinsurance firm had now started marking up prices on properties that were subject to effects of climate change. And I mentioned that to him, and to him that rang true as an indication that the market now was finally taking climate change seriously. I wonder, my knowledge of that is kind of primitive. I wonder if you could reflect on all of that to some extent.
There's an interesting question really about what drives, A, what drives belief, and what's persuasive to people. There's a second question about what will influence change, which is probably separable from the first question. I think that for many people, the idea that the market has not taken it seriously suggests either it's not real, or at least it's unimportant. And there's a validity to that. The market actually engages on things, if you think of it as a refraction of people's views and priorities, things that people want, the market picks up and manufactures on your behalf. You know, we've got iPods in multiple colors because you didn't like them only in black. You start looking at what people want and what happens as a consequence of those. Swiss Re is an interesting example, though. You should be pretty careful about this. Swiss Re has been marking up climate change bonds for almost 25 years. So in that sense, it's got a long history on this particular issue. So the issue partly is we're now hearing more about it. It's coming down to a different kind of dynamic. I am struck, for example, about what happened in Florida. A couple of years ago, the Floridians decided that they would have to self-insure because the state decided to self-insure. And the reason they decided to do that is because the private sector pulled out after the series of hurricanes. That the projections for the increased intensity and the buildup in areas that were more flood-prone, more likely to be heavily affected, not because of climate change, but climate change was an exacerbator of those circumstances, right? It made it worse. And so most of the private insurance companies in Florida pulled out and would no longer insure houses. You can imagine what this did to the housing market in Florida. It killed it. And so the state, or it was projected to kill it. So the state came in and said, we will be the insurer of last resort. So don't worry, you can still insure your house, you can still move here, you can still open a business here and still do that. The state is now on the hook for trillions of dollars. So what's going to most likely happen? If Florida is faced with one of those disasters, the federal government will have to bail out Florida. So we're doing it in a very indirect way, right? We're still marking it up, but we're marking it up with a distribution that gets to everybody in a very different way than the one that you, as the citizen of that place with a liability at that locale, are paying for in the same fashion. We're seeing it in many, many areas. It's harder to get flood insurance now. It's harder to get coastal insurance now. You are increasingly looking at insurance around drought if you're a farmer. It's harder to get that also. All of those things that are related to climate are in fact being picked up. You can see them in the numbers, in the insurance numbers. Swiss Re, the other one's Munich Re, which is another big reinsurance company. AIG had a big reinsurance business. They're in the business of probability. They have a probability of about 100% that there will be increased damages. So we'll go to the back in the middle. We'll go two. Can we have two questions? We have two questions. Go to the front and then the back in the middle.
Yeah. Mine actually kind of correlates with what he was asking, and I was getting down to the grassroots level, is what are we doing to encourage societal changes, particularly in the developed countries like ourselves, which would hopefully influence these China and India and other countries which are trying to become very westernized, since we obviously push the need for this overconsumption beyond our population needs?
The answer is it's coming from a number of different things. It is clearly not penetrating to what most Americans think about as their priority requirements. I'm struck, for example, by the conversation currently around gasoline prices. So gasoline prices are now again hovering back at around $4 a gallon. They were there a couple of years ago. And we're seeing this kind of increase, and we're seeing really a significant objection on the part of the American people. We should not have gasoline prices be so high. And to a certain extent, certainly the gasoline drives American consumption and an American lifestyle. And you have suburban economies that live on the commute. And you have a model in which the existence of fairly low-priced energy, gasoline included, is a sine qua non of our development agenda. And we object when it's changed. And our solution is a supply-side solution, not a demand-side solution. We go down the route of looking for alternatives. We look for biofuels. Maybe we look for electric vehicles. I think in our society, that's likely to be an effective solution. I think we'll get a little bit of the demand side reduction, but I don't know if it'll be very fast. And my own sense about it is that it's likely to be less than we need, and we are likely to still be copied by others. There's a new car that's been developed in India, developed by Tata Energy. And it's a small car. It's costs about $1,500 for a brand new car. It's tiny. It's kind of like, imagine a motorcycle with four wheels, with a tin roof, and it's got nothing in it. But it's a car. It's not a motorcycle. The idea of getting, give or take some, 700 million of those driving around India is daunting from the perspective of the consumption of fossil fuels. It's an internal combustion engine. It's pretty efficient. It gets about 45 miles to the gallon. So in that sense, it's not bad. But there are none of them out there right now, and that growth model is very much predicated on what people want in India. They want mobility. They want to get around. They want to have personal choice in a way that none of us would gainsay. And so you're looking at a question of how, in that context, you can find alternatives. And then take one alternative model. I was just in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi, and we had a meeting of the IPCC 2 weeks ago. And one of the things they've got there is this new renewable city. It's called Masdar City, really an interesting place. Some people here who are working on architecture or design of cities, urban development, very, very interesting developments there. And where are they going on the car side? Well, they actually worked on this personal transport pod. And you get in, and it's got no driver, and there's no steering wheel, and you've got a little computer screen on the side. You get in, and the doors kind of close, and you press the button of where you want to go, and it drives you to where you want to go. And there are dozens of these things running around this little city, and you get them, and they're available whenever you need them. And you can call them up, and they come to your site wherever you happen to be. That sounds great. They're all electric. They run on magnetic lines under the street, and they're all programmable. You can go any destination in the city you want to go. They put $1 billion into that program, and it covers about 3 square blocks. You start thinking about these costs, we are not there yet for the alternatives. And the things in our society that we're looking for, we have a vision of where we want to get to, and I believe we can get there, but it's going to require a lot of work. One last question in the back. Yeah. I guess this fellow over here in the white shirt, this plaid shirt.
So by all accounts, these negotiations were incredibly hard work, and all you yourself and all who have been working tirelessly toward an international agreement are to be congratulated. Having worked through seemingly intractable problems with entrenched interests, I'm wondering if any insights and lessons learned from these international negotiations could help in the perhaps even harder work of congressional negotiations, getting us to take domestic action to reduce carbon emissions.
That's a great question. The answer is there is a microcosm in any given negotiation that I think is also reflected in any given polity. So if you take a look at the United States Congress, I can find representatives of every single view represented by our members of Congress and international players. I did this map at one point in which I took the United States, and each state I compared its emissions to a country. So you actually think about, well, what's the country? How do you think about it? And I can't remember what Illinois was, but you kind of think about Texas as kind of the Saudi Arabia version, right? So there they are with a vision, and it turns out that Texans are a Saudi Arabian in multiple scenarios. And you take a look at New York, and New York is kind of up there in the east, and it's kind of got a European flavor. You take a look at California. California is kind of the Germany equivalent. Very interesting dynamics in this playing out. But you see it in Congress. There are people in the international community who don't believe climate change is real. There are people in Congress who don't think it's real. There are people in the international community who think it's real, but not worth the candle, not worth the cost. There are people in Congress who think that. There are people in the international community who think that climate change is real and urgent, the small island states. Turns out American Samoa has got a representative in the U.S. Congress, and he is way worried about this issue. His name is Falio Mavega. He's a great guy, actually, very active voice in the effort to move forward in climate. But the United States, in by and large, the people who were not of the view that it's an important problem, are also disinclined to take the advice of the international community. And one of the things that I think is important is to think about how we in the U.S. play in an ever-increasingly global world. We are no longer in a model in which the United States is the world's largest player and sitting on that pinnacle by ourselves. We are the second largest emitter now. China is the largest. We are, by the year probably about 2020 or 2021, going to be the second largest economy. China will be the largest. India is going to be the third largest, not Europe. You start thinking about the world as a different world than we grew up in. It's a world in which we're going to have to figure out how to coexist more effectively and successfully, and that's a world that requires engagement. And in my mind, this is an agreement which is about engagement, but one in which our solutions have so far not yet matched the severity of the problem. And certainly our domestic engagement is falling far short of even that international ideal. That's a somewhat bleak note to end on. But let me thank you all for coming. It's been great to talk to you. Happy to take any more questions if you want to join me now. But thank you again for taking time.